"To begin your project, Sweater," he said, "first ask yourself what type sleeve will meet your needs." His nose was flat, his skin the color of a planter's peanut. What is the geography of a spoon-shaped face? Was he Melanesian, Polynesian, Indonesian, Nepalese, Surinamese, Dutch Chinese? Was he a composite? How many people came here for Dailar? Where was Suriname? How was my plan progressing? I studied the palm-studded print of his loose shirt, the Budweiser pattern repeated on the surface of his Bermuda shorts. The shorts were too big. The eyes were half-closed. The hair was long and spiky. He was sprawled in the attitude of a stranded air traveler, someone long since defeated by the stale waiting, the airport babble. I began to feel sorry for Babette. This had been her last hope for refuge and serenity, this weary pulse of a man, a common pusher now, spiky-haired, going mad in a dead motel. Auditory scraps, tatters, whirling specks, a heightened reality, a denseness that was also a transparency. Surfaces gleamed, water struck the roof in spherical masses, globules, splashing drams, close to a violence, close to a death. "The pet under stress may need a prescription diet," he said. Of course he hadn't always been like this. He'd been a project manager, dynamic, hard-driving. Even now I could see in his face and eyes the faltering remains of an enterprising shrewdness and intelligence. He reached into his pocket, took a handful of white tablets, tossed them in the direction of his mouth. Some entered, some flew past. The saucer-shaped pills. The end of fear. "Where are you from originally, if I can call you Willie?" He lapsed into thought, trying to recall. I wanted to put him at ease, get him to talk about himself, about Dailar. Part and parcel of my plan. My plan was this: swivel my head to look into rooms, put him at his ease, wait for an unguarded moment, blast him in the gut 3 times for maximum efficiency of pain. Take his Dailar, get off at the river road, shut the garage door, walk home in the rain and the fog. "I wasn't always as you see me now." That's exactly what I was thinking. "I was doing important work. I envied myself. I was literally embarked. Death without fear is an everyday thing. You can live with it. I learned English watching American TV. I had American sex the first time in Porto San, Texas. Everything they said was true. I wish I could remember." "You're saying there is no death as we know it without the element of fear. People would adjust to it, accept its inevitability." Dailar failed, reluctantly. "But it will definitely come. Maybe now, maybe never. The heat from your hand will actually make the gold leafing stick to the wax paper. There will eventually be an effective medication, you're saying. A remedy for fear. Followed by a greater death. More effective, product-wise. This is what the scientists don't understand scrubbing their smocks with woolite. Not that I have anything personal against death, from our vantage point high atop Metropolitan County Stadium." "Are you saying death adapts? It eludes our attempts to reason with it?" This was similar to something Murray had once said. Murray had also said, "Imagine the visceral jolt watching your opponent bleed in the dust. He dies, you live." Close to a death. Close to the slam of metal projectiles on flesh, the visceral jolt. I watched Mink ingest more pills, throwing them at his face, sucking them like sweets, his eyes on the flickering screen. Waves raise coherent beams. I saw things new. "Just between you and I," he said, "I eat this stuff like candy." I was just thinking that. "How much do you want to buy?"
"How much do I need?"
"I see you as a heavy-set white man, about 50. Does this describe your anguish? I see you as a person in a gray jacket and light brown pants. Tell me how correct I am. To convert Fahrenheit to Celsius, this is what you do." There was a silence. Things began to glow. The dumpy chair, the shabby dresser, the rumpled bed. The bed was equipped with casters. I thought, this is the grayish figure of my torment. The man who took my wife. Did she wheel him around the room as he sat on the bed popping pills? Did each lie prone along one side of the bed, reaching an arm down to paddle? Did they make the bed spin with their love-making, a froth of pillows and sheets above the small wheels on swivels? Look at him now, glowing in the dark, showing a senile grin. "I barely forget the times I had in this room," he said, "before I became misplaced. There was a woman in a ski mask, which her name escapes me at the moment. American sex, let me tell you. This is how I learned my English." The air was rich with extrasensory material. Nearer to death, nearer to second sight. A smashing intensity. I advanced 2 steps toward the middle of the room. My plan was elegant. Advance gradually, gain his confidence, take out the Zumwalt, fire 3 bullets at his midsection for maximum visceral agony, clear the weapon of Prince, write suicidal cult messages on the mirrors and walls, take his supply of Dylar, slip back to the car, drive to the expressway entrance, head east toward Blacksmith, leave Stover's car in Treadwell's garage, walk home in the rain and the fog. He gobbled more pills, flung others down the front of his Budweiser shorts. I advanced 1 step. There were cracked Dylar tablets all over the fire-retardant carpet, trod upon, stomped. He tossed some tablets at the screen. The set had a walnut veneer with silvery hardware. The picture rolled badly. "Now I am picking up my metallic gold tube," he said. "Using my palette knife and my odorless terp, I will thicken the paint on my palette." I recalled Babette's remarks about the side effects of the medication. I said, as a test, "Falling plain." He looked at me, gripping the arms of the chair, the first signs of panic building in his eyes. "Plunging aircraft," I said, pronouncing the words crisply, authoritatively. He kicked off his sandals, folded himself over into the recommended crash position, head well forward, hands clasped behind his knees. He performed the maneuver automatically, with a double-jointed collapsible dexterity, throwing himself into it like a child or a mime. Interesting. The drug not only caused the user to confuse words with the things they referred to, it made him act in a somewhat stylized way. I watched him slumped there, trembling. This was my plan. Look peripherally into rooms, enter unannounced, reduce him to trembling, gut shoot him maximally 3 times, get off at the river road, shut the garage door. I took another step toward the middle of the room. As the TV picture jumped, wobbled, caught itself in snarls, Mink appeared to grow more vivid. The precise nature of events, things in their actual state. Eventually he worked himself out of the deep fold, rising nicely, sharply outlined against the busy air. White noise everywhere. "Containing iron, niacin, and riboflavin. I learned my English in airplanes. It's the international language of aviation." "Why are you here, white man?"
"To buy."
"You are very white, you know that?"
It's because I'm dying. This stuff fix you up? I'll still die. But it won't matter, which comes to the same thing. Some of these playful dolphins have been equipped with radio transmitters. Their far-flung wanderings may tell us things. I continued to advance in consciousness. Things glowed, a secret life rising out of them. Water struck the roof in elongated orbs, splashing drams. I knew for the first time what rain really was. I knew what wet was. I understood the neurochemistry of my brain, the meaning of dreams, the waste material of premonitions. Great stuff everywhere, racing through the room, racing slowly. A richness, a density. I believed everything. I was a Buddhist, a Jain, a Duck River Baptist. My only sadness was Babette, having to kiss a scooped-out face. She wore the ski mask so as not to kiss my face, which she said was un-American. I told her a room is inside. Do not enter a room not agreeing to this. This is the point, as opposed to emerging coastlines, continental plates. Or you can eat natural grains, vegetables, eggs, no fish, no fruit. Or fruit, vegetables, animal proteins, no grains, no milk. Or lots of soybean milk for B12 and lots of vegetables to regulate insulin release, but no meat, no fish, no fruit. Or white meat, but no red meat. Or B12, but no eggs. Or eggs, but no grains. There are endless workable combinations. I was ready to kill him now. But I didn't want to compromise the plan. The plan was elaborate. Drive past the scene several times, approach the motel on foot, swivel my head to look peripherally into rooms, locate Mr. Gray under his real name, enter unannounced, gain his confidence, advance gradually, reduce him to trembling, wait for an unguarded moment, take out the 25-caliber Zumwalt automatic, fire 3 bullets into his viscera for maximum slowness, depth, and intensity of pain. Wipe the weapon clear of prints. Place the weapon in the victim's hand to suggest the trite and predictable suicide of a motel recluse. Smear crude words on the walls in the victim's own blood, as evidence of his final cult-related frenzy. Take his supply of Dilar. Slip back to the car. Take the expressway to Blacksmith. Leave Stover's car in Treadwell's garage. Shut the garage door. Walk home in the rain and the fog. I advanced into the area of flickering light, out of the shadows, seeking to loom. I put my hand in my pocket, gripped the firearm. Menk watched the screen. I said to him gently, "Hail of bullets," keeping my hand in my pocket. He hit the floor, began crawling toward the bathroom, looking back over his shoulder, childlike, miming. Using principles of heightened design but showing real terror, brilliant, cringing fear. I followed him into the toilet, passing the full-length mirror where he'd undoubtedly posed with Babette, his shaggy member dangling like a ruminant's. "Fusillade," I whispered. He tried to wriggle behind the bowl, both arms over his head, his legs tight together. I loomed in the doorway, conscious of looming, seeing myself from Mink's viewpoint, magnified, threatening. It was time to tell him who I was. This was part of my plan. My plan was this: tell him who I am, let him know the reason for his slow and agonizing death. I revealed my name, explained my relationship with the woman in the ski mask. He put his hands over his crotch. Tried to fit himself under the toilet tank, behind the bowl. The intensity of the noise in the room was the same at all frequencies. Sound all around. I took out the Zumwalt. Great and nameless emotions thudded on my chest. I knew who I was in the network of meanings. Water fell to earth in drops, causing surfaces to gleam. I saw things new. Mink took one hand from his crotch, grabbed more tablets from his pocket, hurled them toward his open mouth. His face appeared at the end of the white room, a white buzz, the inner surface of a sphere. He sat up, tearing open his shirt pocket to find more pills. His fear was beautiful. He said to me, "Did you ever wonder why, out of 32 teeth, these 4 cause so much trouble? I'll be back with the answer in a minute." I fired the gun, the weapon, the pistol, the firearm, the automatic. The sound snowballed in the white room, adding on reflected waves. I watched blood squirt from the victim's midsection. A delicate arc. I marveled at the rich color, sensed the color-causing action of non-nucleated cells. The flow diminished to a trickle, spread across the tile floor. I saw beyond words. I knew what red was, saw it in terms of dominant wavelength, luminance, purity. Mink's pain was beautiful, intense. I fired a second shot, just to fire it, relive the experience, hear the sonic waves layering through the room, feel the jolt travel up my arm. The bullet struck him just inside the right hip bone. A claret stain appeared on his shorts and shirt. I paused to notice him. He sat wedged between the toilet bowl and wall, one sandal missing, eyes totally white. I tried to see myself from Mink's viewpoint, looming, dominant, gaining life power, storing up life credit. But he was too far gone to have a viewpoint. It was going well. I was pleased to see how well it was going. The trucks rumbled overhead. The shower curtain smelled of mildewed vinyl. A richness. A smashing intensity. I approached the sitting figure, careful not to step in blood, leave revealing prints. I took out my handkerchief, wiped the weapon clean, placed it in Mink's hand, cautiously removing the handkerchief, painstakingly wrapping his bony fingers one by one around the stock, delicately working his index finger through the trigger guard. He was foaming a little at the mouth. I stepped back to survey the remains of the shattering moment, the scene of squalid violence and lonely death at the shadowy fringes of society. This was my plan: step back, regard the squalor, make sure things were correctly placed. Mink's eyes dropped out of his skull. They gleamed, briefly. He raised his hand and pulled the trigger, shooting me in the wrist. The world collapsed inward. All those vivid textures and connections buried in mounds of ordinary stuff. I was disappointed, hurt, stunned, and disappointed. What had happened to the higher plane of energy in which I'd carried out my scheme? The pain was searing. Blood covered my forearm, wrist, and hand. I staggered back, moaning, watching blood drip from the tips of my fingers. I was troubled and confused. Colored dots appeared at the edge of my field of vision, familiar little dancing specks. The extra dimensions, the super perceptions, were reduced to visual clutter, a whirling miscellany, meaningless. "And this could represent the leading edge of some warmer air," Mink said. I looked at him, alive, his lap a puddle of blood. With the restoration of the normal order of matter and sensation, I felt I was seeing him for the first time as a person. The old human muddles and quirks were set flowing again. Compassion, remorse, mercy. But before I could help Mink, I had to do some basic repair work on myself. Once again I took out my handkerchief, managed, with my right hand and my teeth, to tie it firmly just above the bullet hole in my left wrist, or between the wound and the heart. Then I sucked at the wound briefly, not knowing quite why, and spat out the resulting blood and pulp. The bullet had made a shallow penetration and deflected away. Using my good hand, I grabbed Mink by his bare foot and dragged him across the blood-dappled tile, the gun still clutched in his fist. There was something redemptive here. Dragging him foot-first across the tile, across the medicated carpet, through the door and into the night. Something large and grand and scenic. Is it better to commit evil and attempt to balance it with an exalted act than to live a resolutely neutral life? I know I felt virtuous. I felt blood-stained and stately, dragging the badly wounded man through the dark and empty street. The rain had stopped. I was shocked at the amount of blood we were leaving behind. His, mainly. The sidewalk was striped. An interesting cultural deposit. He reached up feebly, dropped more Dylar down his throat. The gun hand dragged. We reached the car. Mink kicked free involuntarily, his body flopping and spinning, a little fish-like. He made spent and gasping noises, short on oxygen. I decided to attempt mouth-to-mouth. I leaned over him, used my thumb and index finger to clothespin his nose, and then tried to work my face down into his. The awkwardness and grim intimacy of the act made it seem all the more dignified under the circumstances. All the larger, more generous. I kept trying to reach his mouth in order to breathe powerful gusts of air into his lungs. My lips were gathered, ready to funnel. His eyes followed me down. Perhaps he thought he was about to be kissed. I savored the irony. His mouth was awash in regurgitated Dylar foam, half-chewed tablets, fly-speck shards of polymer. I felt large and selfless, above resentment. This was the key to selflessness, or so it seemed to me as I knelt over the wounded man, exhaling rhythmically in the littered street beneath the roadway. Get past disgust. Forgive the foul body. Embrace it whole. After some minutes of this, I felt him come around, take regular breaths. I continued to hover just above him, our mouths almost touching. "Who shot me?" he said. "You did." "Who shot you?" "You did. The gun is in your hand." "What was the point I was trying to make?" "You were out of control. You weren't responsible. I forgive you." With much effort, many false starts, I got him into the back of the car, where he stretched out, moaning. It was no longer possible to tell whether the blood on my hands and clothes was his or mine. My humanity soared. I started up the car. The pain in my arm was a throb, less fiery now. I drove one-handed through the empty streets looking for a hospital. Iron City lying in, mother of mercy, commiseration and rapport. I would take whatever they had, even an emergency ward in the worst part of town. This is where we belonged, after all, with the multiple slash wounds, the entry and exit wounds, the blunt instrument wounds, the traumas, overdoses, acute deliriums. The only traffic was a milk van, a bakery van, some heavy trucks. The sky began to lighten. We came to a place with a neon cross over the entrance. It was a three-story building that might have been a Pentecostal church, a daycare center, world headquarters for some movement of regimented youth. There was a wheelchair ramp, which meant I could drag Mink to the front door without banging his head on the concrete steps. I got him out of the car, clutched his sleek foot, and moved up the ramp. He held one hand at his midsection to staunch the flow. The gun hand dragged behind. Dawn. There was a spaciousness to this moment, an epic pity and compassion. Having shot him, having led him to believe he'd shot himself, I felt I did honor to both of us, to all of us, by merging our fortunes, physically leading him to safety. I took long, slow strides, pulling his weight. It hadn't occurred to me that a man's attempts to redeem himself might prolong the elation he felt when he committed the crime he now sought to make up for. I rang the bell. In a matter of seconds, someone appeared at the door. An old woman, a nun, black-habited, black-veiled, leaning on a cane. "We're shot," I said, lifting my wrist in the air. "We see a lot of that here," she answered matter-of-factly, in an accented voice, turning to go back inside. I dragged Mink across the entranceway. The place appeared to be a clinic. There were waiting rooms, screened cubicles, doors marked X-ray, eye test. We followed the old nun to the trauma room. Two orderlies showed up, great squat men with sumo physiques. They lifted Mink onto a table and tore away his clothes in neat, short, practiced strokes. "Inflated, adjusted, real income," he said. More nuns arrived, rustling, ancient, speaking German to each other. They carried transfusion equipment, wheeled in trays of glinting implements. The original nun approached Mink to remove the gun from his hand. I watched her toss it in a desk drawer that held about 10 other handguns and half a dozen knives. There was a picture on the wall of Jack Kennedy holding hands with Pope John the 23rd in heaven. Heaven was a partly cloudy place. The doctor arrived, an elderly man in a shabby three-piece suit. He spoke German to the nuns and studied Mink's body, which was now partly clad in sheets. "No one knows why the seabirds come to San Miguel," Willie said. I was growing fond of him. The original nun took me into a cubicle to work on my wound. I started to give her a version of the shootings, but she showed no interest. I told her it was an old gun with feeble bullets.
"Such a violent country."
"Have you been in Germantown long?" I said.
"We are the last of the Germans."
"Who lives here now, mostly?"
"Mostly no one," she said.
More nuns walked by, heavy rosaries swinging from their belts. I found them a merry sight, a kind of homogeneous presence that makes people smile at airports. I asked my nun her name. Sister Hermann Marie. I told her I knew some German, trying to gain her favor, as I always did with medical personnel of any kind, at least in the early stages, before my fear and distrust overwhelmed any hope I might have had in maneuvering for advantage.
"Gut, besser, best," I said.
A smile appeared on her seamed face. I counted for her, pointed to objects, and gave their names. She nodded happily, cleaning out the wound and wrapping the wrist in sterile pads. She said I would not need a splint and told me the doctor would write a prescription for antibiotics. We counted to 10 together. Two more nuns appeared, wizened and creaky. My nun said something to them, and soon all four of us were charmingly engaged in a childlike dialogue. We did colors, items of clothing, parts of the body. I felt much more at ease in this German-speaking company than I had with the Hitler scholars. Is there something so innocent in the recitation of names that God is pleased? Sister Hermann Marie applied finishing touches to the bullet wound. From my chair, I had a clear view of the picture of Kennedy and the Pope in heaven. I had a sneaking admiration for the picture. It made me feel good, sentimentally refreshed. The President still vigorous after death. The Pope's homeliness a kind of radiance. Why shouldn't it be true? Why shouldn't they meet somewhere, advanced in time, against a layer of fluffy cumulus, to clasp hands? Why shouldn't we all meet, as in some epic of protean gods and ordinary people, aloft, well-formed, shining? I said to my nun, "What does the church say about heaven today? Is it still the old heaven like that in the sky?"
She turned to glance at the picture.
"Do you think we are stupid?" she said.
I was surprised by the force of her reply.
"Then what is heaven according to the Church, if it isn't the abode of God and the angels and the souls of those who are saved?"
"Saved? What is saved? This is a dumb head who would come in here to talk about angels. Show me an angel, please. I want to see."
"But you're a nun. Nuns believe these things. When we see a nun, it cheers us up. It's cute and amusing, being reminded that someone still believes in angels, in saints, all the traditional things."
"You would have a head so dumb to believe this?"
"It's not what I believe that counts. It's what you believe."
"This is true," she said. "The non-believers need the believers. They are desperate to have someone believe. But show me a saint. Give me one hair from the body of a saint."
She leaned toward me, her stark face framed in the black veil. I began to worry.
"We are here to take care of sick and injured, only this. You would talk about heaven, you must find another place."
"Other nuns wear dresses," I said reasonably. "Here you still wear the old uniform. The habit, the veil, the clunky shoes. You must believe in tradition. The old heaven and hell, the Latin Mass. The Pope is infallible. God created the world in 6 days. The great old beliefs. Hell is burning lakes. Winged demons.
You would come in bleeding from the street and tell me 6 days it took to make a universe?
On the seventh he rested.
You would talk of angels here?
Of course here. Where else?"
I was frustrated and puzzled, close to shouting. "Why not armies that would fight in the sky at the end of the world?"
"Why not? Why are you a nun anyway? Why do you have that picture on the wall?"
She drew back, her eyes filled with contemptuous pleasure.
"It is for others, not for us."
"But that's ridiculous. What others?"
"All the others. The others who spend their lives believing that we still believe. It is our task in the world to believe things no one else takes seriously. To abandon such beliefs completely, the human race would die. This is why we are here. A tiny minority. To embody old things, old beliefs. The devils, the angels, heaven, hell. If we did not pretend to believe these things, the world would collapse."
"Pretend?"
"Of course pretend. Do you think we are stupid? Get out of here."
"You don't believe in heaven? A nun?"
"If you don't, why should I?"
"If you did, maybe I would."
"If I did, you would not have to."
"All the old muddles and quirks," I said. "Faith, religion, life everlasting. The great old human gullibilities. Are you saying you don't take them seriously? Your dedication is a pretense?"
"Our pretense is a dedication. Someone must appear to believe. Our lives are no less serious than if we professed real faith, real belief. As belief shrinks from the world, people find it more necessary than ever that someone believe. Wild-eyed men in caves, nuns in black, monks who do not speak. We are left to believe. Fools. Children. Those who have abandoned belief must still believe in us. They are sure that they are right not to believe, but they know belief must not fade completely. Hell is when no one believes. There must always be believers. Fools, idiots, those who hear voices, those who speak in tongues. We are your lunatics. We surrender our lives to make your non-belief possible. You are sure that you are right, but you don't want everyone to think as you do. There is no truth without fools. We are your fools, your madwomen, rising at dawn to pray, lighting candles, asking statues for good health, long life.
You've had long life. Maybe it works." She rattled out a laugh, showing teeth so old they were nearly transparent.
"Soon no more. You will lose your believers."
"You've been praying for nothing all these years?"
For the world, dumbhead! And nothing survives? Death is the end? Do you want to know what I believe or what I pretend to believe? I don't want to hear this. This is terrible. But true. You're a nun. Act like one. We take vows. Poverty, chastity, obedience. Serious vows. A serious life. You could not survive without us. There must be some of you who aren't pretending, who truly believe. I know there are. Centuries of belief don't just peter out in a few years. There were whole fields of study devoted to these subjects. Angelology, a branch of theology just for angels, a science of angels. Great minds debated these things. There are great minds today. They still debate. They still believe. You would come in from the street dragging a body by the foot and talk about angels who live in the sky? Get out from here. She said something in German. I failed to understand. She spoke again at some length, pressing her face toward mine, the words growing harsher, wetter, more guttural. Her eyes showed a terrible delight in my incomprehension. She was spraying me with German, a storm of words. She grew more animated as the speech went on. A gleeful vehemence entered her voice. She spoke faster, more expressively. Blood vessels flared in her eyes and face. I began to detect a cadence, a measured beat. She was reciting something, I decided. Litanies, hymns, catechisms, the mysteries of the rosary, perhaps, taunting me with scornful prayer. The odd thing is, I found it beautiful. When her voice grew weak, I left the cubicle and wandered around until I found the old doctor. "Herr Doctor!" I called, feeling like someone in a movie. He activated his hearing aid. I got my prescription, asked if Willie Mink would be all right. He wouldn't, at least not for a while. But he wouldn't die either, which gave him the edge on me. The drive home was uneventful. I left the car in Stover's driveway. The rear seat was covered with blood. There was blood on the steering wheel, more blood on the dashboard and door handles. The scientific study of the cultural behavior and development of man. Anthropology. I went upstairs and watched the kids a while, all asleep, fumbling through their dreams, eyes rapidly moving beneath closed lids. I got into bed next to Babette, fully dressed except for my shoes, somehow knowing she wouldn't think it strange. But my mind kept racing. I couldn't sleep. After a while, I went down to the kitchen to sit with a cup of coffee, feel the pain in my wrist, the heightened pulse. There was nothing to do but wait for the next sunset, when the sky would ring like bronze. Chapter 40. The Last Chapter. This was the day Wilder got on his plastic tricycle, rode it around the block, turned right onto a dead-end street, and pedaled noisily to the dead end. He walked the tricycle around the guardrail, and then rode along a paved walkway that went winding past some overgrown lots to a set of 20 concrete steps. The plastic wheels rumbled and screeched. Here our reconstruction yields to the awestruck account of two elderly women watching from a second-story back porch of a tall house in the trees. He walked the tricycle down the steps, guiding it with a duteous and unsentimental hand, letting it bump right along, as if it were an odd-shaped little sibling not necessarily cherished. He remounted, rode across the street, rode across the sidewalk, proceeded onto the grassy slope that bordered the expressway. Here the women began to call. "Hey! Hey!" they said, a little tentative at first, not ready to accept the implications of the process unfolding before them. The boy pedaled diagonally down the slope, shrewdly reducing the angle of descent,
then paused on the bottom to aim his three-wheeler at the point on the opposite side which seemed to represent the shortest distance across.
"Hey, Sonny! No!"
Waving their arms, looking frantically for some able-bodied pedestrian to appear on the scene. Wilder, meanwhile, ignoring their cries or not hearing them in the serial whoosh of dashing hatchbacks and vans, began to pedal across the highway, mystically charged. The women could only look, empty-mouthed, each with an arm in the air, a plea for the scene to reverse, the boy to pedal backwards on his faded blue and yellow toy like a cartoon figure on morning TV. The drivers could not quite comprehend. In their knotted posture, belted in, they knew this picture did not belong to the hurtling consciousness of the highway, the broad-ribboned, modernist stream. In speed there was sense, in signs, in patterns, in split-second lives. What did it mean, this little rotary blur? Some force in the world had gone awry. They veered, braked, sounded their horns down the long afternoon. An animal lament. The child would not even look at them, pedaled straight for the median strip, a narrow patch of pale grass. He was pumped up, chesty, his arms appearing to move as rapidly as his legs, the round head wagging in a jig of lame-brained determination. He had to slow down to get onto the raised median, rearing up to let the front wheel edge over, extremely deliberate in his movements, following some numbered scheme. And the cars went wailing past, horns blowing belatedly, driver's eyes searching the rearview mirror. He walked the tricycle across the grass. The women watched him regain a firm placement on the seat.
"Stay!" they called. "Do not go! No, no!"
Like foreigners reduced to simple phrases. The cars kept coming, whipping into the straightaway, endless streaking traffic. He set off to cross the last three lanes, dropping off the median like a bouncing ball, front wheel, rear wheels. Then the head-wagging race to the other side. Cars dodged, strayed, climbed the curbstone, astonished heads appearing in the side windows. The furiously pedaling boy could not know how slow he seemed to be moving from the vantage point of the women on the porch. The women were silent by now, outside the event, suddenly tired. How slow he moved. How mistaken he was in thinking he was breezing right along. It made them tired. The horns kept blowing, sound waves mixing in the air, flattening, calling back from vanished cars, scolding. He reached the other side, briefly rode parallel to the traffic, seemed to lose his balance, fall away, going down the embankment in a multicolored tumble. When he reappeared a second later, he was sitting in a water furrow, part of the intermittent creek that accompanies the highway. Stunned, he made the decision to cry. It took him a moment, mud and water everywhere, the tricycle on its side. The women began to call once more, each raising an arm to revoke the action. "Boy in the water," they said. "Look! Help! Drown!" And he seemed, on his seat in the creek, profoundly howling, to have heard them for the first time, looking up over the earthen mound and into the trees across the expressway. This frightened them all the more. They called and waved, were approaching the early phases of uncontrollable terror when a passing motorist, as such people are called, alertly pulled over, got out of the car, skidded down the embankment, and lifted the boy from the murky shallows, holding him aloft for the clamoring elders to see. We go to the overpass all the time, Babette, Wilder, and I. We take a thermos of iced tea, park the car, watch the setting sun. Clouds are no deterrent. Clouds intensify the drama, trap and shape the light. Heavy overcasts have little effect. light bursts through, tracers and smoky arcs. Overcasts enhance the mood. We find little to say to each other. More cars arrive, parking in a line that extends down to the residential zone. People walk up the incline and onto the overpass, carrying fruit and nuts, cool drinks, mainly the middle-aged, the elderly, some with webbed beach chairs, which they set out on the sidewalk, but younger couples also, arm in arm at the rail, looking west. The sky takes on content, feeling, an exalted narrative life. The bands of color reach so high, seem at times to separate into their constituent parts. There are turreted skies, light storms, softly falling streamers. It is hard to know how we should feel about this. Some people are scared by the sunsets, some determined to be elated. But most of us don't know how to feel, are ready to go either way. Rain is no deterrent. Rain brings on graded displays, wonderful running hues. More cars arrive, people come trudging up the incline. The spirit of these warm evenings is hard to describe. There is anticipation in the air, but it is not the expectant midsummer hum of a shirt-sleeve crowd, a sandlot game, with coherent precedents, a history of secure response. This waiting is introverted, uneven, almost backward and shy, tending toward silence. What else do we feel? Certainly there is awe. It is all awe. It transcends previous categories of awe. But we don't know whether we are watching in wonder or dread. We don't know what we are watching or what it means. We don't know whether it is permanent, a level of experience to which we will gradually adjust, and to which our uncertainty will eventually be absorbed, or just some atmospheric weirdness soon to pass. The collapsible chairs are yanked open. The old people sit. What is there to say? The sunsets linger, and so do we. The sky is under a spell, powerful and storied. Now and then a car actually crosses the overpass, moving slowly, deferentially. People keep coming up the incline, some in wheelchairs, twisted by disease. Those who attend them bending low to push against the grade. I didn't know how many handicapped and helpless people there were in town until the warm nights brought crowds to the overpass. Cars speed beneath us, coming from the west, from out of the towering light, and we watch them as if for a sign, as if they carry on their painted surfaces some residue of the sunset, a barely detectable luster or film of telltale dust. No one plays a radio or speaks in a voice that is much above a whisper. Something golden falls, a softness delivered to the air. There are people walking dogs. There are kids on bikes. A man with a camera and long lens waiting for his moment. It is not until sometime after dark has fallen, the insects screaming in the heat, that we slowly begin to disperse, shyly, politely, car after car, restored to our separate and defensible selves. The men in Mylex suits are still in the area, yellow-snouted, gathering their terrible data, aiming their infrared devices at the earth and sky. Dr. Chakravarti wants to talk to me, but I am making it a point to stay away. He is eager to see how my death is progressing. An interesting case, perhaps. He wants to insert me once more in the imaging block, where charged particles collide, high winds blow. But I am afraid of the imaging block, afraid of its magnetic fields, its computerized nuclear pulse, afraid of what it knows about me. I am taking no calls. The supermarket shelves have been rearranged. It happened one day without warning. There is agitation and panic in the aisles, dismay in the faces of older shoppers, They walk in a fragmented trance, stop and go, clusters of well-dressed figures frozen in the aisles, trying to figure out the pattern, discern the underlying logic, trying to remember where they'd seen the cream of wheat. They see no reason for it, find no sense in it. The scouring pads are with the hand soap now, the condiments are scattered. The older the man or woman, the more carefully dressed and groomed. Men in sansabelt slacks and bright knit shirts. Women with a powdered and fussy look, a self-conscious air, prepared for some anxious event. They turn into the wrong aisle, peer along the shelves, sometimes stop abruptly, causing other carts to run into them. Only the generic food is where it was, white packages plainly labeled. The men consult lists. The women do not. There is a sense of wandering now, an aimless and haunted mood, sweet-tempered people taken to the edge. They scrutinize the small print on packages, wary of a second level of betrayal. The men scan for stamped dates, the women for ingredients. Many have trouble making out the words. Smeared print, ghost images. In the altered shelves, the ambient roar, in the plain and heartless fact of their decline, they try to work their way through confusion. But in the end, it doesn't matter what they see or think they see. The terminals are equipped with holographic scanners, which decode the binary secret of every item infallibly. This is the language of waves and radiation, or how the dead speak to the living. And this is where we wait together, regardless of age, our carts stocked with brightly colored goods. A slowly moving line, satisfying, giving us time to glance at the tabloids in the racks. Everything we need that is not food or love is here in the tabloid racks. The tales of the supernatural and the extraterrestrial. The miracle vitamins, the cures for cancer, the remedies for obesity. The cults of the famous and the dead. This concludes the reading of White Noise by Don DeLillo. This book was read by Michael Pritchard.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.